This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Coming to you from Vader's White Castle of Fear to talk about wrestling from yesteryear to today, it's the Podcast of Doom. With your hosts, Scott Keith and Brian Bayless.
Good evening, Internet. This is episode number 2 of the Podcast of Doom with your host, myself, Scott Keith, and my intrepid reporter, Brian Bayless. Brian, how are you doing tonight?
Doing excellent. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well, thank you. We have a lot to live up to here after the pilot episode.
That's right.
I don't know the ratings on it, but I'm sure they were through the roof. I can only imagine. So there's actually lots of stuff going on here today to talk about, which is kind of cool. We have breaking news that just came down about an hour ago. I know that people are probably on the edges of seats waiting for this one, so we'll just don't want to leave it any longer. Damian Sandow will be debuting for TNA Impact this week. Did you poop your pants, Brian?
That's pretty big.
It is pretty big. Although, I guess you won't be able to call Damian Sandow. It's
Aaron Stevens?
Aaron Stevens or Steven Aronson or, something like that. But either way, we'll find out what he's doing in the Impact Zone on Thursday.
I'll be in suspense till then.
Well, maybe he could be like Matt Hardy's stunt double.
Be pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
Kind of play off the Miz Sandow thing in WWE, just do it with Matt Hardy now.
Exactly, since Matt Hardy is apparently a movie maker. And his movies can't be any worse than the WWE ones with Miz. So I think it's a role that would work very well for Sandow.
We'll wait and see.
All right. Moving on here. Ratings came in, and it looks like both Raw and SmackDown got completely destroyed by the Olympics, which probably isn't a huge surprise, but still not good news on either front there, I'd say.
Yeah, Raw was down 12%, it looks like, but it was still the most watched show on cable. So it did have that going for it. But all 3 hours were under 3 million viewers, which is certainly not good.
Yeah, not really a good way to spin that one as such. They're down a lot, under 3 million, as you say. SmackDown was down, according to this vote, 8% from last week, it says. And again, obviously, all due to the Olympics. But I mean, back when the show was doing really good every week, they were up against stronger stuff than the Olympics was, especially because the Olympics are down quite a bit this year, it sounds like, as well. So I don't know. Is the shine off of the new brand split and the new era, do you think, yet?
Maybe not quite yet. As far as our ratings, the Olympics probably play a little bit of a factor into it. And there's also a lot of people on vacation this time of year as well. If you look at the ratings hourly, they didn't really drop that much. They kind of maintained till the last hour, dropped a tiny bit.
That is true. Yeah, Raw was pretty steady overall. So, I mean, even though the show was down a lot, apparently due to women watching the Olympics, it does seem like they've kind of hit their floor of the hardcore fans who will watch that crap whatever they put on there, more or less. So I guess that's good news that they've almost found what the basement is now.
Yeah, I guess when Monday Night Football starts up, that'll be the real telling tale of how low it can go, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Monday Night Football is going to beat on them like the U.S. basketball team did to every other country in the Olympics. Sports reference. Ha! How about that?
It's a good one.
Yeah, thanks.
I got it.
Yeah, good. Yeah, excellent. No, I didn't watch Raw on Monday night. I've heard actually varying reports on the quality levels of it here. Meltzer seemed to really hate it on the radio show, but I don't know. I thought there was some interesting things going on there. I mean, you can't say they're not trying right now. I mean, they're giving it a go, I have to say.
Yeah, the only thing about Raw this past Monday was a comedy, a lot of bad comedy. And bad comedy is just really tough to watch. But I like the Rusev stuff, and I thought Reigns looked the best he has in a long time in a speaking role on Raw. He looked comfortable out there.
Yeah.
And the fans even got behind him at the end. So.
Yeah, I think we should have like a running counter on the Podcast of Doom here, something along the line. The is Roman Reigns over yet meter, right? We'll have to set up the thing. I'd say I'd put him at about, I don't know, at a 0.1% chance right now of getting over. The Rusev stuff helped a little bit. I thought, you know, he got a slight reaction, but it's like to the point now where, you know, he's been pushed as a top guy for 2 years and he goes out there and gets a slight reaction in a U.S. title feud and you know, the head office probably freaks out with excitement because, you know, it's finally working now. You know, it's George Bush on the deck of the battleship, you know, the mission accomplished, right? So
absolutely.
You know, they'll probably think that their job is done now and you'll go right back to that. But I did watch highlights on YouTube because that's the only way I can digest watching Raw now at this point is watching the compressed into 5 minute version on YouTube. Yeah, so Lana took a really awesome face first bump into the birthday cake, I thought, which was really impressive because Jim Cornette's kind of the gold standard for birthday cake bumps, and there hasn't been a really good one in a long time. So I thought that was kudos to her for that one, really, really giving it her all because she's been so totally wasted lately, I thought, in the role that she's been asked to play. But, you know, Rusev and Lana going out there as the obnoxious married couple, even though, you know, they're playing second fiddle to Miz and Maryse, of course, who are already doing the same kind of act. It's, you know, Rusev's just awesome, really. Like, he can do everything right now. He's a great, great man. And hopefully he can rub some of that on to Roman Reigns as well.
Yeah, Rusev's great. He really is such an awesome performer. Even in the ring, he's great in the ring too. Just everything about him. He's and Lana was great, like you said. She sold the cake bump well, and her anger afterwards is awesome too. I mean, they did great with the material they had. They certainly rose above it, I thought.
Yeah, unfortunately, though, the payoff is going to be Roman Reigns getting the title and then getting pushed back to the top again. So it's makes it a little bit bittersweet knowing that, you know, that really it's always going to be their end game because, you know, they're not doing this for the purpose of having Roman Reigns be a mid-card guy holding the U.S. title. Like the point is to prep Roman for the main event again during the fall. So, I've heard it argued that this was kind of the role that Roman Reigns should have had from the beginning when he broke off from the Shield, you know, going out there and beating up on the mid-card champion and winning that and kind of working his way up. I don't know. Do you think that would have been more effective way for him?
Absolutely. Even the character he did last Monday, I thought the character should be all along that kind of character or just silent and kicking ass. Just doing the PG Rock routine was terrible. He hasn't recovered from that, in all honesty. And that would sink any performer at that level of material he was given.
Yeah, it's the Vince McMahon hands-on thing was really kind of the problem. You know, the writer's script and everything, forearm suffering, succotash, all that stuff. I mean, I don't know if he would have gotten over without it. I think actually being around Daniel Bryan at the time of year that he was just too much of a hill to climb for him. Sure. But I mean, it's, you know, it certainly didn't help. So moving on. More firings besides Damian Sandow, of course. Joey Styles will, in fact, let go from his position as vice president of digital media, which basically amounts to the guy running the WWE.com website, which is really too bad. I actually really liked the WWE website as of late. They had I don't know what specifically was JoJo behind it and what guys, but like really entertaining stuff as far as features go and things like the trip into the past where they showed slideshows of the costumes like that guys had in developmental phase and that kind of thing. There's really really cool stuff in there. Doomed himself by going and giving an interview and speaking his mind as he wanted to do and blew up his own career. So I don't think he does Joe in the NA Impact Zone, do you think?
I don't think so. I think he has a job outside of wrestling too, and marketing, I believe. So I think if not the WWE, I don't think he's going to go to TNA and not get paid in the warehouse over there, whatever they do.
Yeah,
he'll probably stay where he is, his own full time job.
It's funny though because there was somebody like Joey Styles who can go and market them and would probably work for a relatively inexpensive amount of money. Like they, one thing, the thing that TNA has never really recovered from, I think, is losing Don West, because Don West was, you know, an idiot, but he was a guy who was so enthusiastic about the product that he made you want to go out and buy a T-shirt.
He was great at that role. He did the shop at home deal for years here. I used to watch that just to laugh at him as a kid. He'd sell baseball cards, and it was hilarious how mentally he went doing that. But he was great at it. He was great.
Yeah,
he
did anything look good. That's the kind of thing that Joey Styles could kind of excel at. And, like, God knows they needed a better, you know, Josh Matthews or whoever they have now going out there like that. So I think that Joey could have done it. But, it just shows again that these guys are kind of terrified for their jobs, and apparently rightly so. It's not like Joey Styles went out there and said anything that everybody else wasn't thinking as it is. Like, he basically went out and said that, you know, the Universal Championship is a stupid name for a title, which it is. And I can't remember what other controversial thing that he said supposedly, but I mean, like,
he said
really
some
ridiculous
stuff about Roman Reigns, I think.
There you go. There's the bullet in the head.
He said the stuff about mums are the ones who bring the kids to the show, and mums and kids are the ones who like Roman Reigns, and he second-guessed Vince for pushing him. And that was probably not good for his WWE career.
Okay, well, that pretty much says it all. But okay, you know, so we don't want to oppose the Roman train, which is – it's really amazing. I don't want to go off on the whole Roman Reigns thing again, but the level of tone deafness that this company has with the guy to the point where they, you know, fire people for saying things against him is just absolutely astonishing, because I guarantee you that Joey Styles is a more valuable commodity to have around, especially with the WWE Network becoming kind of the cornerstone of their business, than, you know, somebody like Roman Reigns is to have around, who was frankly a replaceable part of the company now at this point. I mean, they literally replaced him with Dean Ambrose. So, I mean, Joey Styles is a much more valuable cog, I think. But that's the way that they work their business. Speaking of Dean Ambrose, he went on the Stone Cold podcast after Monday, which sounds like it was a much more noteworthy undertaking than Raw itself was, judging by the way people were freaking out over it for some reason. I watched a lot of it. I don't know. The things he said were not unreasonable, I don't think. His basic point was that he wanted to go out there and do a crazy brawl with Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania and have something epic and memorable. And Brock didn't really want to do that because Brock's in it for Brock, and he's out there to take the money and get his payday and not worry about, you know, making Dean Ambrose look good or putting him over or anything like that. And, you know, hey, I can understand. Brock's going to Brock, right?
Yeah, and Brock probably knew he was going to UFC to fight anyway, too, and didn't want to jeopardize that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't really blame Brock for that. I mean, I do blame them for kind of making that match in the first place. If that's the way that it was going to go, I honestly would have rather they had just blown off that stupid Wyatt family program then and, you know, thrown him in there, let him destroy Braun Strowman and Eric Rowan 2-on-1 or 3-on-1 or whatever ridiculous way that they're going about that, rather than wasting Dean Ambrose. It kind of felt like the way they put it together, they were trying to cash in on the, you know, Dean Ambrose getting hotter, and they had no intentions of actually cashing in on it. And here's this big match that fans won and were putting out there for them, and then there was no reason to have the match, and there was, you know, you're not going to job out Brock Lesnar to Dean Ambrose, and Brock Lesnar had no intention of making Dean Ambrose look strong in the defeat, so there was no point to it at all. And I mean, I don't blame Ambrose or Brock Lesnar for it. I blame the people above them who were making the match, really.
Right, and Lesnar had no real opponent for that WrestleMania anyway. They had to use him, basically, so they did what they did, and it was unmemorable, to say the least.
It is what it is, as they say. Austin also kind of challenged Ambrose on a lot of things, especially near the end. He was talking about how Dean was getting complacent, because, I mean, Dean's known as, you know, like a really kind of laid back guy, part of that group of millennials, those darn kids who just play video games in the hotel rooms and aren't interested in going out and partying like the big. But I guess Dean's point to that was that, well, you know, it's a different business now, and it's hard to break through and be edgy anymore. But I mean, I don't know. I think Dean's vote is kind of as edgy as they let him be. I'm not sure what else that they want out of it. I don't think I'd want to see him be like the new Cactus Jack and going out there and, you know, breaking his neck with crazy bumps and attitude era table spots and all that thing. I mean, kind of, it had a time and a place, and I think it's kind of past now. And I, you know, hey, if Dean Ambrose can make some money being the wacky guy who's goes home and plays video games at the end of the day, then great. Good for him.
Yeah, I agree. I actually like Ambrose the past couple weeks on SmackDown with the Ziggler feud. I think he's been pretty good on the mic. It's a different era. It really is, like you said. And they don't have the capacity to go off cuff and do what they want out there. It's not bullet points anymore. It's pretty much a script. So you can't really derive from that too much.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, Dean's been really good. You know, from what I've been watching of SmackDown, he's definitely been kind of carrying the brand more than I thought he would. I mean, I think they're really kind of giving him a little bit of a run with it.
Yeah, and he kind of has to. Last night they had no Styles or Cena on the show, so it was him. He was a big star. Oh, and Orton, I guess, too. But
yeah. Yeah, well, so what are your thoughts? Do you think they're doing too much mixing of the brands at this point now, or do you think it's kind of inconsequential because the whole thing is just lip service for USA Network anyway?
It's tough to say. The whole Foley Bryan thing on Raw, it was a waste of time, complete waste of time. They hyped it up all show and nothing happened, and then they had Lesnar and Norton attack each other on different shows last week, and it's tough to say if they're going to keep on doing this in the future. I'm assuming a Survivor Series have some interpromotional 5-on-5 match or something that they usually did back in the last brand split era. But I think they're probably going to try to keep the brand separate for the most part, I think, for at least for a couple months to sell that. But you never know what this
is going to be. It feels like, yeah, already they're – it's like what's the point if they're just going to dive in? Especially like you're saying with – yeah, so Daniel Bryan on Raw, it was just a really, really strange thing because it was hyped for a couple of days afterwards, and it was almost literally the only thing hyped on the show, and really they had no plan for what they were going to do with, you know, with either him or Mick Foley on there. Mick Foley also feels especially pointless. Like if he's going to be Stephanie's underling, I don't know why they just don't have Stephanie, you know, running the show and be done with it.
Yeah, both guys so far are underwhelming. I think Brian's actually even more underwhelming. He just smiles all the time. That's all he does, really. I don't get the point of his role. Him and Shane run around and just agree all the time, I guess, while Mick and Steph are the ones that aren't really on the same page. And Steph controls Mick through a tablet, I guess, now. But they really haven't done much so far to make anybody get excited over these roles.
I'd say Brian's more effective in his act. On the Cruiserweight Classic, especially his commentary this past Wednesday. That's something, if you watch him, that's where you really feel like his passion for the sport. Like he was going crazy like a little kid watching those matches, especially Jack Gallagher, who, by the way, might be my favorite wrestler now.
Oh, he's great.
That was tremendous.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah. Probably going to actually, I imagine I'm going to watch it again tonight here. A little later on tonight, I'll be live tweeting for Twitter and had their minds blown when I was actually using Twitter for something other than, you know, reposting stuff from the blog.
Yeah.
It was a pleasant surprise for everybody. So looking forward to that. We can talk about now. NXT Brooklyn Takeover 2 coming up actually next week, August the 20th. What are you looking forward to more, Brooklyn Takeover or SummerSlam?
For me personally, I'm a little bit behind on NXT, although they're putting together a great card. And I even think SummerSlam's a great card, too.
Yeah, they both are, actually.
But I guess just because I haven't seen much NXT, I'm probably looking forward to SummerSlam the most. I'm hoping you're going to binge watch NXT next week when I'm off a little bit, so I have some time to catch up on it.
Well, the nice thing with NXT, I guess you can call it nice, is even if you're missing the weekly shows, they do a really good job of keeping you up to date, basically, on the takeover shows, which is good in the sense that for somebody like myself who can just pop in and out and watch it when I need to, it's fine. But on the other hand, the show has really become kind of disposable and not something that you need to watch from week to week. So I've pretty much fallen out of the habit now of actually watching it. It's kind of like it's a lot of squashes, and you know it's reasonably entertaining when it's on, but it's so easy just to go onto the website and pick it up because it's very simply booked, right? Which is, you know, it's a good thing as far as that goes, but it does, you know, make it easy to drop out of it. The main event title match for TakeOver Brooklyn, Samoa Joe defends the NXT title against Shinsuke Nakamura in the match I am insanely geeked to see. It's also kind of a tricky one because I have no idea who is going to win that match because neither guy can really afford to lose. But at the same token, I wish both guys would lose so they can get called up to the main. Personally, I think they should just put the title on Nakamura and send Samoa Joe up there so he can build towards something with Brock Lesnar. But I like Samoa Joe as well. I don't know. Who are you rooting for, Brian?
I think that Nakamura might win this match. I think they need someone to carry NXT for a little bit right now, and he's probably got to do it. And, you know, Joe's had a good run as a champ down there, and he can really be valuable to the roster right now, especially on SmackDown. They need depth on SmackDown of some people that can go on that brand.
Yeah, definitely. Samoa Joe's a guy he's TV ready. He's been on TNA for a lot of years. They can just throw him in there and, you know, have some good matches on SmackDown and everything. Oh, of course, the problem being that he would be on a different brand than Brock Lesnar, because really the only reason to bring him up would be to build to a feud with Brock. But, you know, hey, Randy Orton's feuding with Brock, and he's not the same brand, so they don't really care about that. Anyway, I think it's going to be it should be a great match, though. I mean, Nakamura knows how to matches with guys like Joe, and Joe's always super motivated on these. Another great match, probably going to be Asuka against Bayley for the women's title. This is another one where I have mixed feelings on it, because as much as I really like Bayley and the story that's, you know, internally in NXT should build to Bayley winning the title, it is just way beyond time that she needs to be up on the main roster. With Sasha and Charlotte doing their thing at SummerSlam, which we can talk about in a little bit, that's an easy way to throw Bayley in there afterwards. She would fit in perfectly, I think, on TV. She already got a big reaction on the last pay-per-view, but I don't know. I don't really want to see her lose again as a fan, but I want to see her lose as somebody who wants to see her on the main roster. So another one I'm conflicted about there.
Yeah, I think Asuka will probably take that one. She'll probably retain the belt. And like Bayley really does need to be in the main roster at this point. Not much else she can do down in NXT. She's been there for a few years, and with the lack of depth on the women's roster, especially on SmackDown, I don't know if she'll go there now. She'll probably go to Raw, but she needs to be in the main roster.
Yeah. And kind of the last really big match in there, aside from a couple of debuts, is the Revival, the only two-time NXT Tag Team Champions, defending the belts against Gargano and Ciampa. That should be a hell of a match. Apparently, they are just like burning down the house in every house show that they're doing right now.
Yeah, I've read those live reports. It's every time they go out there, people love it.
Did you see the Ciampa against Gargano match from the Cruiserweight Classic last week?
I love that match. That was a great match. I'm not the biggest Ciampa fan to begin with, but that was a great match. I like that a lot.
The powerbomb into the lung blower, just I shit myself. I swear it was amazing. My jaw dropped. I'd never actually seen him do that move before, although then I immediately got bombarded with snarky people telling me I should watch more ROH. But I don't get ROH up here. I'm in Canada. Jesus. But I thought the match was fantastic, because I mean I had no real exposure to Gargano and Ciampa up until kind of their NXT thing, and they had a good match with the Revival. But yeah, that match against each other really made me into a fan of them. And I'm pretty sure that they're going to pull out all their crazy shit for NXT TakeOver here and blow everybody away. So I'm really looking forward to that too. So they've got three really solid matches on the top of that show. And I mean, really, for a two-hour show on there, that's all I need out of it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, three great matches is all you need. And No, what's the other matches? I kind of forget the rest of the card right now. I think it's Aries versus No Way Jose. Is that a match?
Yeah, Aries against No Way Jose and Bobby Roode against the flop that is Andrade. However you say his name.
The former La Sombra.
What the hell was wrong with La Sombra? Like, really? Why does he need to be Conan now, you know?
He had a great thing going to Mexico, too, with that act. He was awesome. If you ever watch any CMML, you could probably find some of his matches on YouTube. It's just phenomenal as a heel, too. Just excellent. And he's doing this stupid gimmick here, and no one cares about him.
Seems to be misguided. I really like No Way Jose, oddly enough.
He's an awesome character, a great mid-card character. Just the goofy mid-card, fun character. I mean, wrestling needs a lot of those. You don't see too many of them anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so another show I'm really looking forward to is SummerSlam. So we can check that out now here before we kind of hit the break. They've done a really good job, I think, of building up the top matches so far. There's some really good stuff looking on the top there. Even though I'm not down with this match lineups thus far. Top match, I'd say, I guess, end with Brock against Randy Orton. That seems to be the featured match. And I can't imagine it being a bad match. Although the idea of Randy Orton going out there and getting flung on his shoulder over and over again seems like a really stupid idea, but it should be a fun match, I think.
I do too. It should be a good one. They built it up well enough. And Orton's been kind of fun in his return, I thought. He's been great playing to the crowds.
He's like mellow dad Orton now. It's kind of a strange thing for him, but he was the Viper, and now he's like the guy who hurt his shoulder taking. So yeah, that's an interesting dynamic that they're going on. Now I don't know where to land on the card exactly. I guess it doesn't really matter since Orton Lesnar is a big one anyway. But then you have kind of underneath that the finals of the Universal Title Tournament with Finn Balor making basically his in-ring debut, since he only had a couple of matches on Raw and then hasn't been back there again, taking on Seth Rollins for the title. Some people have been telling me that it might not be such a good match, which is strange to me. I don't see why it would be bad. Seth Rollins is awesome, and he's not going to have a bad match in this situation. And you know that Finn Balor is going to go out there in full demon garb and try to blow everybody away. So I think that could be another classic one, personally.
I do too. Interesting who will win that match. With Balor debuting the demon character in the WWE for the first time, I don't know, having him lose like that wouldn't be the greatest idea, I don't think.
No, I don't think so. That would be, I don't know, I can see them doing it, but that would be a weird way to go. On the other hand, though, I don't think they really want him to be the Universal Champion yet. They obviously don't trust him based on kind of the way that they've used him on Raw so far. And I guess they could have him win it and then drop it kind of right away or at the next pay-per-view or whatever. But I don't know. My gut feeling is that Seth Rollins walks out with the title here, even though it's kind of not the best way to go with it, I don't think. Next up, we have Dean Ambrose defending the WWE title or SmackDown World title or whatever they're going to end up calling that title against Dolph Ziggler. Not really looking forward to it as far as storyline goes. I know that Dean's done a really good job kind of making it seem more important and carrying the feud, but I'm just, much like Dolph Tights, I'm over it right now with Dolph at this point. This feels like kind of Dolph's last shot.
Yeah, it must be. I give Dolph credit in this role. I think he's actually stepping up his game a lot, and his promo work with Dean a couple weeks ago, that was great, the back and forth. He looks actually like he cares in the ring now. His offense might actually hurt somebody over the age of 4 years old. But I highly doubt he's going to win this match.
Yeah, I can't see them making, Dolph Ziggler world champion again on that one. Next up, another title match that's anticipated. Sasha Banks defends the women's title against Charlotte. The Raw match was awesome. Like, the Raw match was probably my favorite women's match probably my favorite women's match of the year so far. It was a super strong match. I was just really into it. And, they're going to get time here on pay-per-view, especially since it's going to run 16 friggin' hours. So, they got lots of time to go out there and do their thing. And I think it's going to be excellent. I think they could actually steal the show with this one.
Yeah, it should be a great match. I really don't see how Sasha's going to drop the belt already. So I assume she wins this and the feud with Charlotte, Charlotte finally ends. They can find someone else with Sasha to wrestle for the next couple months.
Yeah, I found the buildup of Sasha kind of strange, though. Especially when she's such an effective heel character, and they're going out and making her a babyface because people like her so much. But it's like she's not real likable babyface. You know, she goes out there and she acts like a total bitch to everybody. And people like her because she's awesome, but not because she's a real likable person. And then the other thing that I found kind of mystifying was when she went out to build up the match, rematch in Brooklyn I had this great, the great match with Bayley, and it's like the main crowd knows and likes Bayley, but the main crowd doesn't really watch NXT TakeOver. I mean, NXT TakeOver is watched by a fairly small percentage of the Raw crowd. So it was kind of a strange move to go out there and play that off as some kind of legendary match when really not many people were going to be. It just made her look second rate, I guess.
Yeah, it did. And that did not get a good reaction with the live crowd either.
Yeah, it's like, going out there and, celebrating your AAA baseball championship, which is not to denigrate NXT, because NXT is awesome. But I mean, it's a smaller audience, and there's a reason why Raw is the major league and NXT isn't. Also, as if the card wasn't stacked enough already, there'll probably be a 4-star John Cena AJ Styles match thrown in there as well, for good measure. I'm quite surprised, actually, that they didn't go immediately back to it after they had a really good match at Money in the Bank. I thought, they'd go back into it, but instead they had the 6-man. So it's been nice, actually. They've had a couple of months now where they haven't had singles matches, but they've still been interacting with each other. AJ feels like he's cooled off a lot, I think. He was somebody that, when he went to SmackDown right away, I thought they would have shot the title onto him, made him a top guy. AJ's still been great in the mic work, but it doesn't feel like he's, kind of an immediate threat to be a top guy anymore, which is kind of a shame.
Yeah, the draft, ever since the draft, he really hasn't done much. He had that one match, the 6-man match, to be the number one contender, and since that he cut a promo and he was away in Australia when Raw was going on. I mean, SmackDown was going on this week. But this should be a great match. As far as who wins, isn't Cena going to be filming True Grit again fairly soon?
Yeah, I don't know.
There was the rumor he would not be on the September 11th SmackDown-only pay-per-view of Backlash. And if that's the case, you'd have to think AJ would win that. But
I was, I thought they were going to shoot AJ to the top via the Cena feud. But, I mean, he lost the 6-man match, and he got pinned by Cena. So either that signifies that they're done with him as a top guy, or else they're going to 50-50 back to AJ again after the feud. So I don't know. As long as it's a great match, it's fine.
And AJ could also beat Cena and then challenge Ambrose to the title at the pay-per-view too.
He could also do that as well. Yes, absolutely. Another match that is rather strange and has me more excited than I should be, I suppose. Enzo Amore and Big Cass against the very unusual, wacky tag team of Chris Jericho and Kevin Owens. Where the hell did they come up with this one, Brian?
My only explanation is that they're teaming Owens and Jericho up so they can feud and turn Owens' face at some point, because otherwise I don't know what the end game of these two are together.
Yeah, it feels like if they're doing the wacky tag team partners thing, it almost feels like it should have been, Owens and Sami Zayn forced to team together for, somehow like that. It seems like it would have fit. I don't know. Chris Jericho, it feels like such an odd fit in this one. Like, I don't know. I haven't really been digging the Jericho thing so much since he came back, but yeah. Also, we got the New Day defending the tag team titles against Gallows and Anderson as they continue shooting for Demolition's tag team title record. This one seems like a pretty clear way for them to build to the Big E return spot from his ruptured testicle of doom that he suffered there. And obviously the most heinous ring post ball shot in history, judging by the amount of time that he's been out already from it.
And did you see that skit on Raw, the doctor skit with Gallows and Anderson?
Yeah, why didn't he say he was Doc Gallows? Like, it was right there. It could have served it up for him, and they just left it there. That was kind of disappointing, actually.
That was some awful comedy right there. Awful.
Yeah. Why do you sign Gallows and Anderson, bring them in as badasses, and then have them doing bad comedy as doctors? Like, what?
Yeah, ever since they broke the club up with AJ, it's neither guy. They really don't feel like anything special at all anymore, Gallows and Anderson.
Well, it was really weird, too, because when they did the brand split and, they broke the club up, and AJ did this whole thing on Twitter about how, oh, no, the club is expanding. We're not breaking up. And it's like, no, they're just a bunch of guys now. Yeah, you got the tag team geeks, and then, you have AJ Styles who's just kind of doing his own thing. I mean, I suppose they could go with the Finn Balor heel turn and do the Balor Club like was originally planned all along, but I don't know. This is not a good direction for Gallows and Anderson. Doesn't feel like that they're serious challengers to end the New Day's epic title reign at this point. I think clearly Enzo and Cass are the way that they're going to go with it. But I suppose they could have Gallows and Anderson win it and transition to Enzo and Cass. I don't know.
I think that might be the way they go. And if it isn't, and Gallows and Anderson don't get the titles here and lose this feud, I think that just says they gave up on those two pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I don't know what you do with them after that. Who are they going to feud with?
I don't know. They can feud with the Usos until they all die, I guess. But they really did. Yeah, whatever. That's not like they've so far as it is. They really did give up on Gallows and Anderson really fast, which is really weird because, like, how do you not know what to do with Gallows and Anderson, right? Like, this is the easiest thing in the world. You know, you have the big evil monsters come in, beat the shit out of guys, win the titles and dominate and build up to somebody winning it from them, like, an Enzo and Cass. And, yeah, it's Lord Tensai all over again.
Ugh.
Ah, I know. All right, so we're going to take a break now, I think, and come back and talk about Great American Bash 1991.
What a pay-per-view that was.
Yes.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation is JT Rizzuto here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's Past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network. where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
And we're back on Scott's Podcast again. I feel I would be remiss in not mentioning, by the way, that we forgot the Roman Reigns Rusev U.S. during our preview of it here, just to show you how important that Roman Reigns is to the company and how much he's in the minds of everybody. So thanks for checking out the new show here. You can find Scott's Podcast of Doom at placetobenation.com and by subscribing to the Place to Be podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. My show shares a podcast feed with other great programs like the aforementioned Place to Be podcast, Clotheslines and Headlines, PTBN's Main Event, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast. You can learn more about all these programs at placetobenation.com by clicking on the podcast logo on the right side. In addition, there's a number of regular written series going on, including the Raw and SmackDown reviews, Justin and Scott's Vintage Vault refreshes, and PTBN's Excellent Network Adventure. Also, don't forget to check out the PWO PTBN Podcast Network for hardcore wrestling shows like Between the Sheets, Exile on Bad Street, Where the Big Boys Play, This Week in Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, At the Garden, and the Titans of Wrestling. There's more than just wrestling at Place to Be Nation. Be sure to check out PTBN Pop for comics and pop culture audio, our Seinfeld Rewatch, comics reviews, the Wednesday Walk Around the Web, and more. So yes, thanks very much to Place to Be Nation for hosting Scott's Podcast of Doom, the most popular podcast on the internet that stars myself. So I believe we're number one in my demographic, so that's good. Always have a goal to shoot for. And speaking of shows that are number one, The Great American Bash 1991, a show that ranks very highly on the worst pay-per-view of all time lists every time they come out. Also a show very near and dear to my heart, of course, because it's people have asked for my opinion on it millions of times, and I'm always happy to talk about it. It was kind of a show for me that was in a really weird place. It's a wretched pay-per-view, to be sure, on its own. But not only is it a wretched pay-per-view, it's a wretched pay-per-view with a lot of really special circumstances built around it, which makes it really kind of extra wretched in a special way. Mainly because I was so excited to see the show back in 91 when I was in like grade 11. And of course, Lex Luger was probably my favorite wrestler at the time, unfortunately enough. And he'd been built up to getting the world title for, you know, literally years and years. Never been able to beat Ric Flair before. And this was finally going to be his big night, and then everything went to hell. So, yeah, any thoughts in general on Bash 91 before we start here, Brian?
Yeah, this is one terrible show. You know, the whole Flair circumstance was a major factor. Then they had that horrendous scaffold match to start things off. My God.
Yeah, who did look at Dusty?
PN News and a scaffold match.
Yep, that's brilliant. Well, we'll talk about a little quickly about the history behind it for anybody who's in a cave and doesn't know what was going on. So basically, Ric Flair and Jim Herd didn't. Jim Herd was the guy in charge of WCW in 1991, kind of the head bean counter, and he was an unpopular figure in wrestling, to say the least. His ideas was to move Flair down into the mid-card. He felt that Flair, in 1991, mind you, and we're talking about still, you know, some 20 years before he actually did retire, that Flair was too old to be world champion and too old to be a featured guy. So he wanted to dress him up as a gladiator, a la what Farouk would be in 1996, and, you know, have him be a mid-card guy, and also cut his salary pretty much, I think, down to like one quarter of what he was making at that point, if I'm not mistaken. It was really ridiculous contract negotiation they had with him. Even more ridiculous considering the fact that Ric Flair was their world champion at that point, and they really couldn't afford to be screwing around with it. So Flair, near the height of his popularity in the sport, was essentially fired by WCW while world champion. And instead, what WCW presented after months of building up Flair against Luger in their final battle for the World Heavyweight title was Lex Luger against Barry Windham. Barry Windham had been a tag team wrestler for about the past year and was not even a kind of a serious contender to the title. And to say the people in Baltimore were rather annoyed about this situation would be an understatement. But then we had the show that they had to sit and watch before that main event. And it was a bad scene. I'm honestly surprised that there wasn't a riot at that point, considering how much people resented them for Flair leaving. It was kind of like the 1991 equivalent, I guess, to the Roman Reigns Daniel Bryan situation. It would be kind of the closest thing as far as, you know, the promotion phasing out somebody who the fans really wanted to see as the top guy, and the fans basically being told, you know, to go screw themselves by the promotion. Very unique dynamic, to say the least. But yeah, so it was Baltimore, Maryland, normally the hotbed of great wrestling. And the show kicked off with a scaffold match. PN News and Bobby Eaton against Steve Austin and Terry Taylor. And I don't know where the idea. Now, scaffold matches are not my favorite matches to begin with, to say the least. And the idea of putting four people up on a scaffold and then making it half as wide as the previous ones were, and then basically rejecting the entire premise of the match by making it a capture the flag situation instead was absolutely ludicrous. And why would you put PN News that high up in the air is another question that I would have. And why would you take three other great wrestlers who do great mat wrestling and stick them in a scaffold match? I mean, it was just completely boneheaded opening match to do. There was no point to it. It was really stupid. Which is kind of a very appropriate way to kick off this terrible, terrible pay-per-view, I suppose.
Yeah, it really set the tone for the whole night.
Yep. I gave that one -4 stars, my previous rant. I feel like that's being kind of generous to it. In fact, it's not only one of the worst opening matches of all time, I think it ranks up there with some of the worst matches ever on pay-per-view. So, I mean, just really bad decision-making all around from the company. And then, so at that point, then Jim Ross comes out and tells the crowd and the people at home, oh, yes, by the way, Ric Flair is no longer the WCW World Champion. So that's a hell of a way to get the crowd excited then. At that point, then, just really twist the knife on them there. Next up, you had the Diamond Stud against Tom Zink. And Diamond Stud was, of course, Scott Hall and another classic WCW gimmick going out there. And basically, you'd think he was squashing Tom Zink. Odd choice of a match for pay-per-view. Like, that was kind of like a, you know, opening match on WCW main event, and just one that didn't really fit on this kind of show. I don't know. What did you think of Scott Hall as the Diamond Stud? Didn't do it really for you either?
He really wasn't much of a wrestler at this point.
It's kind of hilarious, actually. You know, I'm going back and doing the Observer flashbacks around this time. Like, Dave Meltzer, he hates Scott Hall so much. It's like, I never thought he was a great wrestler or worker or anything like that. But I mean, like, but man, like he must have really turned the corner as a worker to, you know, get the kind of respect that he eventually did from Dave. Because, like, Dave has just been, at the point I'm in now in 1987, Dave's been slagging the guy for like 3 years straight. And I mean, you know, Diamond Stud was not exactly a a gimmick to turn things around for him. But I mean, at least it was better than stuff. Yeah, it's better than the other stuff. It was. I mean, when him in '96, the initial feeling from everybody was that, you know, they're just going to be Vinny Vegas and the Diamond Stud again, which wrestling world would have been much different if that had been the case. It was a decent match at any rate. I thought it was going to be kind of a squash for Diamond Stud, but it wasn't really. They just kind of went back and forth. They had a decentish little 2-star match, and it was fine, which is better than you can say for most of that show. Now to the highlight, the pay-per-view debut of Kevin Nash as the Great and Powerful Oz, taking on Ron Simmons. I was amused watching this back again when. Because this was the only time he was dyeing his hair to make it even more gray, as opposed to the way he ended up later. But this was fabulous. I mean, how can you not love TBS getting the rights to the Wizard of Oz, and then going out there and sticking Kevin Nash in a wizard costume to somehow be a top star, and then this is what resulted from it.
Yeah, Nash himself is pretty funny about being stuck with this gimmick. But what a terrible idea. And he overcame it, though, later on.
He did, multiple-time world champion.
He wasn't a career killer. He came back, but this is just, whoa, boy. And Kevin Sullivan is the Great Wizard.
Yes.
Another tremendous character.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, Oz, of course, didn't even win the match. Ron Simmons beat him with a shoulder block. As I noted, they found his one weakness, a simple bump. Which is true. Kevin Nash does not like to leave his feet. And next up, we had the WCW Top 10 for the week.
No.
For those, yes. I kind of missed that, actually. I think Ring of Honor does rating systems now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think Evolved is a Top 5, too, I believe.
Evolved is Top 5, yeah. We should bring back the Top 10. If only because I still have many jokes about the WCW Top 10 that I can go through and use. Any chance here? Thankfully, Lex Luger and Barry Windham were number 1 and 2 in the rankings. Because, I mean, if they're going out there and having somebody lower down in the top 10, that would have just made the entire show a joke then. I mean, geez. I hope somebody... Glad to see some people paying attention, at least, on this one here. Oh, and another highlight of the show up next. Oh, God. It just keeps getting, it's hit after hit on this show. The breakup of the Rock and Roll Express. The tragic end to it as the lifelong partners met in the ring. Ricky Morton against Robert Gibson. And yet another misguided idea. There was a reason that nobody ever did a breakup angle with him, and that's because Robert Gibson sucks. And if he's not in there with Ricky Morton carrying him for the entire match, then you get the result of something like this boar fest, which was literally Ricky Morton laying on the ground and working the knee for something like 15 minutes. Yeah, 15 minutes. 15 minutes of Ricky Morton working on the knee. And you're telling me that this crowd didn't riot? They have way more patience than I would.
Yeah, this match sucked. It just flat out sucked. The whole thing was garbage. No one cared about the Morton heel turn. And in 1991, the Rock and Roll Express weren't a hot act at all anyway. So,
well, the Rock and Roll Express, they were dead by 87.
Yeah.
Just going back now, doing these flashbacks, is kind of amazing. I didn't realize at the time, but reading through it, the crowds are turning on the Rock and Rolls back in 87 even. And, by that time even the act was done, and they just kind of kept hanging on for a few years after that, way past they should have, the point when they should have. It was really sad, and then even worse was Ricky Morton couldn't even commit to his own heel turn. Like, he was supposed to be an evil corporate villain, and he goes out there with his, stupid bandanas around his legs, and he wouldn't cut his hair or put it in a, change his hairstyle.
The thought of him as a corporate heel is hilarious in itself.
Yeah, exactly.
If they had a sense of humor back then, they should have put him in a suit and make him carry on a Halliburton and really go with it. Haven't struggled to adapt to the corporate world, but no, the whole York Foundation thing was terrible too.
Oh, it was lazy booking at worst. Yeah, it was just, that's the thing I really hated about it. It wasn't offensively bad, but it was just so lazy. And they couldn't even get Alexandra York a real computer. She had like one of those crappy little word processor things. I mean, God, what is she, like Dave Meltzer? Like she'd carry like a typewriter with her or something like that. Even. All right. That match, by the way, was a big fat dud. Next up, here on the flashback rant, we have an elimination tag match with the Fabulous Freebirds and Bad Street against Dustin Rhodes and the Young Pistols. And I've really come to appreciate the Young Pistols over the years. They were really hardworking, and they carried a lot of guys in the mid-card. This was not one of those matches, unfortunately. Nobody gave a shit here. At this point, it was getting, you know, the Freebirds were coming off of their negative title reign, something that only wrestling can produce. And clearly they wanted out, and Michael Hayes wanted kind of out of the business, and Jimmy Garvin wanted to go be a pilot or whatever the hell he wanted to do. And poor Brad Armstrong stuck in the bodysuit as Bad Street. You know, it was just the whole point in 1991 with Dusty as the booker was, of course, to give the Roman Reigns push to Dustin Rhodes and line up six different people at the same time for them to bounce off of Dustin's elbows and make him into the big star. And it was just this kind of the result of this kind of. It was just kind of a lazy, sloppy six-man match of guys who saw the crowd reaction. And
yeah, that was weird. All the eliminations happened like right in the last few minutes too.
Yeah, that too.
Standing out and the rapid fire eliminations at the end weren't very good. I mean, before that, the match was just mediocre. And sadly, it was probably the second best match of the night. The third match. And the chain match wasn't that bad, I guess.
The chain match wasn't that bad, yeah. So next up we have the Yellow Dog against Johnny B. Bad. And that's another one. You think you look at, like, you know, Brian Pillman against Johnny B. Bad, that should be just, you know, ridiculous, bad comedy, overbooked. You know, the all these guys, you know, ripping off the Midnight Rider gimmick over and over again. And it's law of diminishing returns with it. The last time I thought it was actually an effective idea was the Mr. America thing, just because they were just so over the top stupid with it. And, you know, there was no attempt made to make it serious at all. But it was kind of an okay match. And again, it didn't seem like anybody really cared on the night. Next up. Oh boy. Yeah. God, I keep forgetting how terrible the show was. Black Blood against Big Josh. So, yeah, poor Billy Jack Haynes. As if he wasn't insane enough as it is, then, you know, dress him up as an executioner. Which, I never got that. Like, at least Billy Jack Haynes was kind of a known name. Like, you know, he had a bit of a name and a bit of a star power, at least. And why would you dress him up as something that Jack Victory would usually, you know, go out there and wrestle as? It just made no sense to me. Like, you know, it was a totally WCW move to take somebody who could have at least drawn a little bit as a name from a few years ago and just, you know, turn him into a generic jobber, basically.
Yeah, these guys work together in Portland, too. They're both from Portland, so I don't know if they work together at any feuds there at all.
Oh, yeah, they must have. Yeah, I mean, sure they had a million matches with them. But the main question I had coming out of it was, like, what exactly was he going to do with the giant axe?
Oh, that was such a stupid gimmick.
Was he literally going to behead somebody in the ring? Is that what it is? Like, he was going to behead somebody on national TV and then, you know, get away with it? I don't understand. There's no internal consistency with this gimmick.
Yeah, he doesn't like lumberjacks, I guess. Who knows?
Really, who does like lumberjacks?
Lumberjacks, executioners, we got rappers, we got all sorts of shitty characters on the show.
I mean, really, they both had axes. So, you know, they could have built something on that. They could have had, like, a tree chopping competition or something. I don't know.
Better yet, they could have put them on the scaffold and had a capture the axe match.
Capture the axe match. See, there you go. Now you're thinking. And as the question I still haven't had answered yet or not, do you have to check a bloody axe at the airport? Like, how do you get that onto the plane? Like, how do you explain that? All right, next up. Another classic match in a series of Elegante taking on the One Man Gang.
Oh boy.
Oh boy. I don't know. What do you say about Elegante?
He was a big dude, and that's pretty much why he was in wrestling. He had no really considerable talent other than being menacing and 7'3", whatever the hell tall he was. This match was odd. It was like a comedy match, basically. It wasn't even the worst thing of the show, sadly enough. Not even close to it, probably. But yeah, he couldn't actually wrestle a match. He was just a huge attraction guy.
I should point out, by the way, that One Man Gang used a wrench on him at one point, an actual wrench, and still couldn't get the win. So I don't feel too bad for One Man Gang in here. But yeah, it was terrible. Okay, next up, another match, which was, I suppose, kind of half decent. I didn't like it as much on second viewing as I did originally. The chain match between Sting and Nikita Koloff. Speaking of people who don't give a shit, Nikita Koloff was just so far gone from the business at this point that I don't know why he was even bothering back then. I mean, God bless him. It's wonderful that, you know, he found his way as a minister and, you know, found something to do outside of wrestling afterwards. But I mean, geez, 1991 was not a good year for him. He should have just stayed.
Yeah, it wasn't 1986 anymore. I can tell you that.
It definitely wasn't. No. And even 1986, he wasn't that great. No. He used to have a really good presence about him, but yeah, 91, obviously he was somebody going in for the paycheck and, so Sting wins the chain match. World moves on. The world title match, world in quotations. That's just really screw it Flair over, right? Because they could have been like, you might have been the world champion, but now we have the universal champion here in WCW. Yep. I feel like that would have been the smart move. Lex Luger against Barry Windham. And boy, if you think Roman gets a crowd hostile against him, the crowd was just ready to shit all over this match from the start. It really didn't matter what they were going to do in this match. Even if they had a really good match, the crowd was still going to turn on them. But fortunately, they did not have a good match. And it was, I guess I call it decent. It wasn't a bad match or anything like that, but Lex Luger is somebody who obviously doesn't care at the best of times. So he wasn't going to go out and show any passion winning the world title, and Barry Windham was beyond broken by this point as well. So it was, they went out, they had, you know, a decent match, and Luger wins out of nowhere with a pile driver at about 12 minutes to capture the world title finally after years of failure and disappointment. And you think this would have been a big deal, but nope, they just kind of moved on. And Luger ended up being a huge flop as champion, and Ric Flair was proven to be right.
Yeah, I really didn't like this match. I thought it was like a really boring, like 80s WWF house show match. They barely did anything at all at the beginning, and then it picked up like the last minute or so, I guess. But this match was terrible. I don't think either guys gave a shit either when they wrestled this one. It didn't feel like a big deal, and the crowd was not having this one.
No, definitely not. And then finally, the main event.
Yeah.
cage match with Missy Hyatt and Rick Steiner against Paulie Dangerously and Arn Anderson. As I noted in here, thankfully, Paulie broke out the Zubaz, so that we all know it's 1991 that this was taking place in. And it, even then, they couldn't really have a match. It was supposed to originally be the Dangerous Alliance against the Steiner brothers. Scott Steiner ripped up his bicep, of course, or tricep, one of them. Anyway, he ripped up his arm really badly previous to that. So it was a mixed tag match. And then the Maryland State Athletic Commission wouldn't actually allow them to have. So they weren't allowed to touch each other. And it was just a quick squash with Rick beating Paulie with a clothesline.
Yeah, they had the Hardliners, Dick Slater and Dick Murdoch, come down and kidnap Missy. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, judging by the way that Dick Slater kind of marries above his station, who knows if he was kidnapping Missy or if maybe he was taking her to a wedding. I don't know. I mean, he's been pretty impressive in the because you wouldn't think that somebody like him would, you know, go out there and get, you know, Luna Vachon and Medusa, but somehow he did.
And he's the guy who, I think back in Mid-South, I think it was, he's the guy Slater stuck Sting's head in the toilet backstage in the show.
That's my favorite angle.
You know, it's a dirty dick. This match is nothing. They should have ended the show with Luger or Windham. There's no need for this match to happen or even happen at this point in the show.
Yeah, I know. It's really weird. Yeah, so overall, WCW bashing anyone, just a complete train wreck. It was a putrid show for a lot of reasons. But, I mean, the thing that was worst about it, I think, was that it was a show that a lot of people were looking forward to for a long time. They'd built up the Lex Luger title chase pretty effectively. Had ripped away because Jim Herd couldn't see the forest for the trees and just had to get rid of Ric Flair right then and there. So it's WCW at its most WCW, unfortunately. So, all right. So that was our flashback rant here for the week on the podcast to do. And I guess we'll hit a few mailbag questions and wrap it up for the week. So let's see what we got here today. Okay. What was the deal with Greg Valentine smashing the old green Intercontinental title? Was it literally just a plot device to introduce a more modern-looking belt without the sweat stains and the meaty thighs of Pedro Morales? Or was there more to it? No, actually, I think that's what it was. It was they had their fancy new belt design in mind, and they needed a way to transition off of it. So, yeah, Greg Valentine lost the title, and he went out and smashed the shit out of it in Baltimore. And, moved it on to – because I think, if I'm not mistaken, they'd already started taping matches with a new belt. So they kind of needed a storyline reason to get it off there. But, I of course, the classic Randy Savage Intercontinental title design was the best one anyway.
That's my favorite, too. That's a great design.
Yeah. There's actually some great stories about Randy Savage on a webpage I linked to a while ago, too, about when he won the world title and the sizing was wrong for him because it had been sized for Hulk for whatever reason. So he ended up putting Velcro on the back of it to change it for himself. Interesting stuff with belts. I always think it's kind of cool. What was the deal with random gimmicks in the late 80s and early 90s, like Duke the Dumpster Drozzy? Did Vince have a list of gimmicks he wanted to do and doled them out as the new guys debuted? Or did each wrestler in question actually have something to do with the gimmick, like Bob Holly is a race car driver? But actually depending on the situation. Excuse me. Bob Holly as the race car driver was something where it was, the gimmick, the real thing turned up to 11 or whatever Vince says. Just because Bob had all this racing experience and kind of wanted to do something. Vince saw that and wanted to do something around it. Other ones, most notoriously from around that time, was things like T.L. Hopper and Freddie Joe Floyd and the Goon. And those ones in particular, as Chris Jericho has detailed, were ones where Vince came up with the gimmicks and then just hired mid-level guys to come in and play them. Because the idea being that USA Network wanted more star matches on TV, but Vince didn't want to actually go out there and do star versus star stuff and have guys lose. So he came up with fake stars so that, Freddie Joe Floyd would get a win on one of the TV shows to make it seem like he was somebody who was going to be built up as one of the new stars. And then, Tracy Smothers would just go out there and – or not Tracy Smothers, the other guy. Anyway, would just go out there and get by the Sultan or whoever on Raw afterwards. So that way then they weren't sacrificing any of the real stars. They were, just sacrificing these fake made-up guys that they threw into the roles like that. So, yeah, and famously Chris Jericho actually was offered the role of the Goon, in fact, in 1995, and thankfully turned that one down because otherwise his – comeback tours would be a lot lamer now these days, when even more lame than they currently are, in fact. The New Day and the New Age Outlaws are two examples of creative having nothing for you and somehow turning crap into gold. Are there any other examples of tag teams doing that? I can think of singles wrestlers who had given crap and overcame it, but not tag teams. I would say Demolition was somebody who turned crap into gold. They were, especially at the beginning, they were certainly not somebody who you would look at as like future tag team champions and dominant guys. They were basically, a couple of former job guys who were put in leather and put out there to rip off the Road Warriors, essentially. And they ended up becoming arguably almost as famous as the Road Warriors were, I think, as a tag team. I don't know. Any other examples you could think of there, Brian?
Some of the 80s WWF teams. I mean, the fabulous Rudra brothers, when they turned heel, I mean, they were just bland, generic baby faces. They turned heel, and whoever thought they would be that great as a heel act? Because they were. I'm watching this stuff now, and they were such a great heel act when they first turned. Like the first several months, just incredible. I mean, the Killer Bees got over. That was a very lame gimmick. They were over 85, 86. Those years, they were pretty over. Trying to think of other teams, too.
The Rougeau Brothers were spectacular as heels. I think actually another one who dropped with Jacques Rougeau was the Quebecers, in fact, as well. Because that's a total nothing gimmick to be given, right? Like, you know, there are two guys from Quebec who are not the Mounties. And they went really far with that gimmick, I think, as well.
And another team, too, which actually started off as a goof, was in TNA, America's Most Wanted. They actually started off because James Storm was like a goofy toy store cowboy, and Chris Harris was pissed off at him. They got teamed up together, and they actually developed a team after that. And who would have thought? They were one of the best teams, or probably 2003, 2005, probably the best tag team in America.
Very true. I almost have to think Beer Money was along the same lines as well, but because they're built around basically the joke name, and they ended up becoming a really solid tag team.
They were great. That was some good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And they could have been in NXT together if James Storm hadn't left.
True.
I don't know. Do you think he made the right play there? Was guaranteed money with TNA for the moment? Do you think better than the opportunity to? Especially if he probably would have been called up to the main roster with a brand split, I think, actually.
I mean, creatively, I don't think he's doing anything in TNA, but I think he's probably about 40 years old at least. So if you're going to get guaranteed money, you might as well do that at that age, I think.
Yeah, age-wise, absolutely. I think he's let's see here. Oh, here's another one about turning crap into gold. In reference to the Flair-Batista Tag Team Champions of 2004... Apparently, I said Batista is a case of huge returns for very little invested. They stuck him in Flair with the tag team for a few months, and Flair turned him from a slug into a really good worker like magic. Almost as though something that used to happen in wrestling all the time. So apply this today. What veteran and newbie pairings would I make? Who would I stick with Jericho, and who would I stick with Apollo Crews? Okay. Who would I stick with Jericho? Well, Kevin Owens isn't really a newbie, obviously. I gotta think. I think actually Jericho with Enzo and Cass would be a really interesting set as like a three-man unit. Almost they all like, you know, they're opposed to each other right now, but it feels like Jericho could just drop right in there with the whole Enzo shtick there and work really well. And they could probably, I don't know, as a babyface unit though, maybe as a heel, but. He could be a good mentor for them, I think. Who would they bring in for Apollo Crews? Well, I don't know. Under WWE rules, it'd have to be somebody black because, you know, black people are only allowed to team with other black people. Booker T, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, in NXT, you got Rich Swann. You got Angelo Dawkins.
Yeah.
Well,
you know,
that's
we
tough.
Need to fit, but Apollo Crews is a newbie, right? So we need to be better. Rich Swann, by the way, is fantastic.
Oh, he's great. He's loaded with charisma.
The thing where he couldn't stop dancing during the referee's instructions and the Cruiserweight Classic last week was just tremendous.
I think if you bring up the New Day down the road and you want another tag team, if you put Rich Swann and Xavier Woods together, their charisma would be off the charts. I think they could make anything work.
That'd be amazing. Yeah, Xavier could play the trombone and Rich Swann could dance to it.
Yeah. Oh, Vince heard that and start that gimmick today probably.
Yeah. Let's see here. Okay. Hey, Scott, what did you think of how WWE introduced the demon aspect of Finn's character? As someone who did not see the explanation of the demon when he was in NXT, I appreciated some sort of explanation but was a little underwhelmed as to why he was introduced. Should there have been more of a reason to introduce the demon? For example, Seth tries to injure him so he can't win the belt by forfeit. Boasts that Finn won't be at SummerSlam, but then Finn appears in the Titantron and says Finn won't be there. But the demon will as he does the transformation. Mm. And finally, is there much different about how Finn wrestles as the demon? Does the demon take more risks, have less control, or blah, blah, blah? No, I don't think so. It's still Finn Balor, but it's more about, like, you know, he's now shit's on, you know, like he comes out, he's got the full body paint, and now you're in trouble, buddy. But, I think definitely there could have been a lot more storyline reasoning behind both Finn's introduction and the demon introduction as well. Like, that's really what it is. Like, you know, the culmination of, like, the way they introduced Cactus Jack at Royal Rumble 2000 gets Triple H there, you know, where, like, we're exactly right, where Finn's getting beat up and, you know, can't take it anymore, and then so he has to go nuclear and bring out the demon then to beat Seth Rollins. But, he's getting a main event on SummerSlam. I'm sure he's not complaining too much about it, but I definitely think, yeah, the introduction was lacking a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. You maybe even did it too soon. I mean, I get doing it at a big event like SummerSlam, but he's only been on the roster a couple of weeks, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Not much time to play up to it.
All right, finally, I'll wrap this one up because my voice is about to give out. What was the story with Hulk Hogan wanting to be in a tag team with Beefcake in 1993? Why would he want to do something like that, which seems so beneath him? Just to give Beefcake something up the higher up the card to do? That's exactly what it was. It was Brutus Beefcake was coming back in. Hogan wanted to, you know, give him the push as his buddy and make him some money. And I don't think anybody seriously thought that Hogan and Beefcake were going to be tag team champions. I know that kind of the thought was that they were going to squash Money Incorporated and hold the belts. But anybody who thinks that Hogan would lower himself to the tag team titles doesn't know Hogan very well, I think.
Yeah, has he ever held a tag team title before? Was it with?
Yeah,
with Edge. That's what I thought.
Yeah, and that was great too. That was the perfect role for Hulk Hogan, actually, in 2002. Right? He's, you know, the hot tag guy who stands on the apron, getting the crowd hyped up, and then, you know, gets tagged in and does the big comeback with the big boot and leg drop. I am kind of sad actually that he destroyed his career, because I think actually he could have done some fabulous stuff with Rusev, not in the ring, but I mean, like, I think just, you know, Hogan going out and being Hogan and then Rusev coming out and mocking him would just have been probably the best. I think that might have been the best thing in the history of wrestling, but now we'll never know because Hogan's a racist.
Yep. He did himself in. And I think it'd be a great GM too, actually.
Yeah. That's exactly the kind of role that he'd excel at. I think could have brought him out there, but I don't know. Time heals all wounds. So probably people will forget in a few months, and, if Hogan, you know, ever needs money again, which seems highly unlikely now at this point, the way the lawsuits are going for him, then, you know, hey, then it wouldn't be the worst idea to bring him back and have him run in one of the shows.
He'll be back by WrestleMania 36 or something. Who knows?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. So, anyway, with that, we'll close up the mailbag here tonight, and we'll call a stop, I think, to the episode number 2 of Scott's Podcast of Doom. So, of course, you can join myself and Brian on blogofdoom.com. I try to post a Wrestling Observer flashback every day now, although unfortunately I didn't get one done last night because I was half asleep. But I'm sure we'll have another one up tomorrow morning. You can also read me on the Sporting News and InsidePulse.com. Brian, you got any plugs to get in here?
You can certainly read my work at theblogofdoom.com. Even a Place to Be Nation, I review Raw and SmackDown, and I took part in the Network Adventure series where we rewatched 1984 Starcade, which was
that's a
thoroughly
adventure.
Mediocre show.
Uh-huh.
With one great match, though, Tully Blanchard and Ricky Steamboat. Watch that one. Skip the rest.
People still email me asking when I'm going to do Starcade 83 and 84. I just keep laughing at them.
Yeah, 83 is good. 84,
not going to happen.
That one.
Yeah, so. And also, of course, you can find me on Twitter. Probably it'll be already done by the time that you hear this, but I will be live tweeting the Cruiserweight Classic tonight on Twitter at RSPWFAQ. And, of course, Brian has a Twitter handle as well.
I do. It's Mr. Bayless 1982. And I tweet out one of every 78 reviews I write, I think. So I might get back in the Twitter game and do some stuff on that, actually.
Yes, social media. I think it's the way of the future. I don't know.
It is.
All right, so hope everybody has a great week. We will see you again back here 2 weeks from now. where we will discuss the results of SummerSlam and NXT TakeOver, I imagine. So have a great night, and we'll talk to you again in a while.
Excellent.